for changing the government of Iran. Well, it's all come to nothing. It's now crumbling in a really embarrassing way. And this is why the United States is so angry tonight.
Thank you very much, Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria, joining us live from Manchester, and Laith Maarouf, activist and political commentator from Beirut. That's all the time that we have for this edition of The Spotlight, and I'm very grateful that you shared your thoughts and views with us in this edition.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here, we enlighten you with the Ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Wa ma takunu fi sha'ni wa ma tatlu وَمَا تَتْلُو مِنْهُ مِنْ قُرْآنٍ وَلَا تَعْمَلُونَ مِنْ عَمَلٍ إِلَّا كُنَّا عَلَيْكُمْ شُهُودًا وَمَا يَعْزُبُ عَنْ رَبِّكَ مِنْ مِثْقَالِ ذَرَّةٍ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَمَا يَعْزُبُ عَنْ رَبِّكَ مِنْ مِثْقَالِ ذَرَّةٍ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَلَا السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Qur'an, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth, or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater, but it is in a clear book.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The United Nations says Sudan's warring parties have seriously violated the humanitarian agreement signed last week to spare civilians and civilian infrastructure. North Korea slams the US and the South for their joint military drills, promising to respond to what it calls warmongers' madness. Also coming up, rapidly spreading wildfires slow the gas flow from Canada's Alberta province to the United States, increasing natural gas prices. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, the United Nations has condemned Sudan's warring parties for serious violations of a humanitarian agreement signed just last week. The deal requires both sides to spare civilians and civilian infrastructure and to let in badly needed humanitarian aid. The UN aid chief said there have been important and egregious breaches of the agreement since it was signed. Martin Griffiths particularly pointed to a recent attack on the World Food Programme office in the Sudanese capital, among many examples. He stressed the need for scaling up assistance to Sudan dramatically to deal with what he called the spiraling situation in the country. The Sudan conflict erupted on April 15 between Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and his former deputy, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, who leads the paramilitary rapid support forces. According to the UN official, around 1,000 people have been killed in and around the capital Khartoum and in the western region of Darfur. Griffiths added that more than a million people have also been displaced by the ongoing battles. The US and Taiwan have finalized talks on a trade agreement to strengthen their economic ties, a move likely to draw anger from China. The US says the deal aims to bring more products to Taiwanese markets and facilitate investment, among other things. The agreement is the latest in efforts by the two sides to deepen relations. It follows Washington's arms sales to Taipei and meetings by top American officials with the Taiwanese president. All those have happened despite strong opposition from China. It regards Taiwan as part of its territory, and it sees Washington's growing ties with the island as interference in Chinese affairs. Beijing also says the U.S. ties with Taiwan embolden pro-independence forces on the island. North Korea once again lashes out at the United States and South Korea for their joint military drills around the Korean Peninsula. Pyongyang accuses the two allies of ramping up what it calls nuclear blackmail. The North has pledged to respond accordingly to what it described as warmongers' madness. It says Seoul and Washington are seeking to crush the North militarily. That's why Pyongyang says it reserves the right to reinforce its self-defense by developing weapons programs. The U.S. and South Korea have stepped up their war games, including air and sea drills, since March. Pyongyang sees the maneuvers as a rehearsal for invasion. It usually responds to them by test-firing missiles, including intercontinental ballistic ones. The North has unveiled designs for new and smaller nuclear warheads as well. South Koreans opposed to the U.S. pressure looming at the G7 on South Korea to cooperate with Japan say the U.S.-led trilateral alliance with Japan needs to take a back seat, and Tokyo must come to terms with history first. Activists gathered for a press briefing in Seoul, critical of the U.S.-led G7 taking place in Hiroshima. Frank Smith is in Seoul.
The Japanese city of Hiroshima is set to host a G7 summit this week, where leaders of the U.S., Britain, France, Germany, Canada, Italy, and Japan will address pressing global issues. The meeting is also a source of controversy in other countries around the world, including South Korea, where activists at a Seoul forum slammed the event as diplomatic whitewashing.
This summit is a tool to conceal the terrible truth that countless Asian and Pacific people had to bleed due to 50 years of Japanese imperialism beginning in the late 19th century. It's a blindfold to cover Japan's hypocritical steps towards a nuclear-free world, peace, and rearmament, while dumping nuclear-contaminated water and scrapping its peace constitution.
South Korea's relations with Japan have always been controversial, but especially now as President Yoon Suk-yeol has sought to improve ties against the wishes of many South Koreans, who demand an apology for what they call Japan's colonial abuses.
As world leaders flock to Hiroshima, South Koreans are reminded of a history the U.S. and Japan might rather forget. When the U.S. dropped the atomic bombs on Japan, in addition to more than 200,000 Japanese, estimates suggest some 40,000 Koreans were killed. Many of them were forced laborers.
Some South Koreans say President Yoon is moving the country too close to the United States and a military alliance with Japan, which is seen as increasing regional tension. Japanese leader Fumio Kishida invited Yoon to the G7.
The South Korean government's participation is mainly to strengthen military cooperation between South Korea, the U.S., and Japan, and further strengthen military cooperation with NATO, which is mainly led by the United States. If South Korea's participation in the G7 was to reinforce the military alliance as a benefit, that can never be a good thing for the peace of the Korean Peninsula, as well as world peace.
While the summit plans to address the Russia-Ukraine war and economic issues, activists also argue the rich G7 nations need to do more to solve the humanitarian crisis now unfolding in East Africa. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Leaders of the group of seven wealthy countries known as the G7 are meeting in Japan with the war in Ukraine a top issue of their talks. The meeting brings together the leaders from the US, Canada, the UK, France, Germany, Italy, and Japan. They are looking to tighten sanctions against Russia over the Ukraine war. The Western officials have said the G7 wants to target Russia's lucrative diamond trade, among other measures. The planned sanctions follow Western restrictions already targeting Russian economy since the Ukraine war began in February last year. Moscow has adapted quickly to mitigate the effects of these sanctions, including diverting trade to countries like China. Russia accuses the West of hostility and failing to meet its security concerns. French President Emmanuel Macron has reached record lows in popularity after cutting unions out of their traditional role in the lawmaking process. Unions finally met with the government regarding the recent two-year hike in the pension age, but only nearly a month after the age hike went into law by executive order. Ramin Mazahari has more from Paris.
For the first time since massive regular protests began in January, the French government has held discussions with union leaders regarding a two-year hike to the retirement age. A notable problem with that long delay is that the age hike has already been forced into law via a decree by President Emmanuel Macron. Public opinion is overwhelmingly against the change, but the government is standing firm, even though anger is rising to threatening levels nationwide. The First Lady's nephew was recently beaten by protesters over the age hike. Over 60% of the country wants the Prime Minister fired, and neither Macron nor his ministers can appear in public without protesters noisily banging casserole pans.
There's enormous anger right now. Macron has destroyed our social services, given huge tax gifts to the rich, persecuted injustices while allowing the far right to demonstrate without barely any police presence. And this is not even a complete list. People just want to live normally. But the Macron era is one of sadness and poverty.
Unions say the country will not get back to normal unless the age hike is revoked. But France has seen massive anti-government unrest regularly for well over a decade, and usually over far-right austerity measures. France and the European Union continue to be hounded by accusations that they are anti-democratic, and the latest of many French presidential decrees has only further increased dissatisfaction and dissent.
There is growing realization that our major national policies are decided in Brussels, and that our president is a mere puppet. We're also subservient to Washington. Simply look at what we're doing in Ukraine for more proof. So there's no hope that we'll have democracy during the last 4 years of Macron's term. But if we don't get it in 2027, things will explode.
Union leaders left the closed-door meeting, calling it not useful and a one-way monologue. The pension age hike has overshadowed other crises, such as record inflation, the arming of the unrest in Ukraine, and stagnant wages. But all of those remain unresolved flashpoints as well. Barring a surprise reversal from the government, unions are planning a 14th day of nationwide strikes next month. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
Officials in Canada's Alberta province say speeding wildfires have slowed the outflow of natural gas into the U.S., increasing prices. They say the gas flowing from Canada to the U.S. has dropped to a fresh 25-month low as wildfires disrupted production. On Thursday, U.S. natural gas figures gained about 2% to hit a two-week high on the reduction in imports from Canada. U.S. gas futures have also gained about 13% over the past 2 weeks since imports from Canada started to decline. There are currently about 92 active wildfires across Alberta, forcing over 10,000 people out of their homes. Officials have warned that more wildfires could spread in the next few days due to record high temperatures and tinder-dry vegetation. Turning to Britain now, where large protest movements of Orthodox religious Jews have been sparked over fears the government tends to force controversial relationship and same-gender lifestyle lessons onto unregistered Jewish faith schools. The dispute has led to several protests, which now sees British Jews branding the government anti-Semitic. Robert Carter reports.
Hundreds of Orthodox Jews protested outside the UK Parliament building on Tuesday over fears the establishment will begin regulating traditional Jewish faith schools known as yeshivot. Protest leaders made clear they considered any legislation targeting unregulated Jewish religious institutions as anti-Semitic, and they may be forced to flee Britain to protect their religious freedoms from unwelcome reforms.
Today, we face a concerning challenge as politicians attempt to push through a proposed register for children educated outside of school. This is no ordinary bill, but one that seeks to sneak in new laws through the back door under the guise of a private member's bill. This register proposal targets our strictly Orthodox Jewish community, intending to undermine our way of life more than any other group. It reeks of state-sponsored anti-Semitism.
What concerns these religious Jewish parents is regulated British education mandates lessons on lifestyles which contradict Jewish religious beliefs, including relationship and sex education, or RSE, LGBT propaganda, and other anti-religious ideologies, including atheism.
Well, we're not talking about murdering anybody. We're just talking about what we don't want our children to be taught. And we're just following what it says in our religion. And it's absolutely disgraceful that you're not allowed to do that in this country. And that's anti-Semitic.
These protests come after years of public anger expressed by parents, particularly British Muslims, over RSE lessons already being implemented in state schools. Opt-out options are not available, and accusations of indoctrination or anti-religious propaganda being fed to young children has been rife. In January 2023, a petition went viral, gaining over 200,000 signatures, demanding the government remove LGBT teaching from the controversial curriculum. The government responded, saying,
"The statutory guidance states that all pupils should receive teaching on LGBT content during their school years. Secondary schools should include LGBT content in their teaching. Primary schools are strongly encouraged and enabled when teaching about different types of family to include families with same-sex parents."
The ruling Conservative government has routinely attacked left-wing opposition over their support for the Palestinian cause and their criticism of Britain's relationship with the Israeli regime. However, and quite ironically, it's now number 10 that finds itself on the receiving end of not only accusations of anti-Semitism, but also Islamophobia and for being anti-religion in general, over an education system which is perceived to be discriminating against religious minority rights. Robert Carter, London.
That brings an end to World News for this hour. Thank you for joining us.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible?
Quran.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من، این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. 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 کتاب الله.
Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people. on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
The Limelight.
New York Mayor Eric Adams, the highest profile black mayor in the country, has gotten so crossways with the White House that he was dropped from Biden's 2024 campaign advisory board before it was announced last week. The rebuke reflects a new law in relations between President Biden and the mayor, who was said to be a key surrogate for the campaign. They are fighting over immigration and crime, and Adams' willingness to publicly criticize the administration. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted the U.S. president has reportedly booted New York's Eric Adams from his re-election campaign team amid criticism over migrant surge. President Joe Biden has apparently had a falling out with the mayor of America's largest city, New York City's Eric Adams, because the fellow Democrat has been criticizing his administration's handling of an illegal immigration crisis. The conflict bubbled on recently when Adams was asked in a Good Day NY's television interview about the city's struggles to cope with a massive migrant influx. The mayor replied, "Where the heck is the President of the United States? That is a good question, and I think we all should be asking why this is happening to a city that was turning itself around and will continue to do so." A surge in illegal crossings of the U.S.-Mexico border to all-time highs began to hit home for New York last year when the governors of Texas and Florida began busing migrants to Democrat-controlled cities. This should not be happening to New York City, Chicago, Los Angeles, and other big northern cities, Adams said, adding, "And really, it should not be happening to El Paso or Brownsville, Texas. No city should be carrying this burden. This is a national problem and it needs a national solution." Feeling pressure from his own constituents, Adams has escalated his criticism of the Biden administration in recent weeks amid increasing struggles to accommodate the illegal aliens streaming into his city. Parents were up in arms over the city's plan to house hundreds of migrants in the school gymnasiums after running out of space elsewhere. Homeless veterans were reportedly kicked out of hotels in upstate New York, where they had been given temporary shelter to make room for illegal immigrants being bused from New York City. Adams was reportedly excluded from Biden's re-election campaign team to punish him for alleged disloyalty. The mayor had announced earlier this year that he would be serving on the campaign's National Leadership Advisory Team, but when the group's official membership list was released last week, Adams was left off. This is a shot to the chops from the Biden team, political consultant Hank Shankoff told New York Post, adding, "The message is, don't criticize an incumbent Democratic president and don't criticize the first black female vice president. Any criticism from a Democrat heading into re-election is seen as a betrayal." Adams hasn't been alone in sounding the alarm over the immigration crisis. New York's governor, Katie Hochul, has asked Biden's administration for funding help and access to federal installations, such as military bases, to house illegal aliens. "You're going to start seeing people living in tents, not just on the border, but in the streets of New York and across New York State, because we've reached a breaking point," she said recently in an MSNBC interview. The website of Axios also reported, "This isn't merely personal. It's part of a potential crisis for the campaign. Many Democratic state and city officials quietly agree with Adams and are happy he is taking flak on their behalf. They're running out of patience with the U.S. administration, especially over what they see as a lack of financial support or imminent solutions for dealing with the massive migration across the southwest border." One senior official in a Democrat-led state said the White House has been too defensive toward Adams' critiques. "Adams is right to be upset, and I think it's a massive mistake to be dismissive of him," the Democrat said. One person familiar with their relationship equated it to a fighting couple who don't want to hold hands in public. Adams has bluntly criticized the White House's handling of the recent surge of migrants crossing the U.S. border. Thousands of migrants, including many bussed in from border states by Republican governors, have arrived in New York City, which guarantees services to migrants that many other cities do not. "The presidents at the White House have failed this city," Adams said in April, a line many Republicans and conservatives have used to attack the Biden administration. "Migration is exacerbating a budget crunch in New York, affecting hotel vacancies and bringing unwelcome headlines for Adams." One New York Post headline last week from Orange County outside the city read, "Homeless vets are being booted from Envy hotels to make room for migrants. The White House is limited in what it can do without backing from the divided Congress, and the administration has had little engagement with the GOP on immigration changes." Biden's incoming campaign manager, Julie Chavez Rodriguez, has been the White House's point person on the Adams relationship as it has deteriorated. She privately has fumed to her colleagues about Adams' stinging rhetoric and public critiques of the administration, according to people familiar with her comments. Presented with this reporting, a White House colleague said, "Of course, calls in which elects you admire, criticize the administration can be frustrating, but she's a pro who always deals with it respectfully and constructively." Adams' bravado occasionally has frustrated White House aides. Even before he won the general election in New York in 2021, Adams declared himself the new face of the Democratic Party. One close Adams ally, Jeff Rhodes, recently told some Albany Democrats that Biden might replace Vice President Kamala Harris with Adams on 2024 ticket. Rhodes, who recently left his job as chief of staff to Adams' first deputy mayor, told Axios that he wasn't saying that the swap would happen, but said there were some thoughts about it. He declined to comment further. After Axios contacted the mayor's office about his quote, days later, Rhodes wrote to Axios, "I have no connection to the president's campaign, have no inside knowledge of their thinking, and the suggestion I would making those kinds of statements is absurd." A person familiar with the White House's thinking told Axios that no one except Harris has ever been considered for the vice presidential spot. In a statement, Adams Press Secretary Fabian Levy told Axios, "To be clear, no one here at City Hall or on the mayor's political operation has ever spoken about the mayor joining President Biden's ticket. There is no truth to that. If anyone said that, they would be speaking on their own with absolutely no authority or insight into what is happening." Top Democrats are trying to repair the Biden-Adams relationship, thinking that the mayor continuing to hammer Biden throughout 2024 campaign would be a drag on the president and a boon to Republicans. Al Sharpton told Axios, "I'm trying to get them to sort it out. I would hope the White House sees the value of Eric, the mayor of the largest city, a black mayor, not all the way left, not all the way right." Sharpton added, noting that Adams also would benefit from a healthy White House relationship. Howard Wolfson, a top aide to former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, told Axios that both sides have a vested interest in resolving this. After the Biden campaign left him off their list of surrogates, Adams told reporters last week, "I don't know what their plans are, but let's be clear. Biden is my guy. I want Biden to be the next president, be reelected." Biden campaign spokesperson Kevin Moniz told Axios, "President Biden counts Mayor Adams as a friend and partner. He looks forward to working with the mayor on issues impacting New Yorkers and to win the presidency again in 2024. One Adam administration official added, "The mayor compartmentalizes things, and that's what's going on here. He thinks the president is doing a really good job and will strongly support him in any way he can, but he is upset about the way he is handling the asylum seeker crisis." White House Deputy Press Secretary Andrew Bates told Axios, "President Biden and his team are proud of their collaborative relationship with Mayor, and Julie appreciates their discussions on a wide range of issues."
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Thank you. visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Midstream.
Years since the usurpation of the land and the displacement of our Palestinian people. 75 years of continuous suffering for three generations that are still groaning in pain and the occupier stealing their dreams. 75 years of persecution and distortion. 75 years of Nakba. 75 years of UN resolutions that are not worth the ink used to write them. 75 years of Zionist arrogance with British, French, American, and Western criminal support. 75 years and the faces of the supposed Arab brothers are revealed. All allies up of Satan, advocates of falsehood, and conspirators against the Palestinian rights, history, and future. Yet at the dawn of the 75th year of Nakba, Palestinians continue their struggle in various forms. A great nation who did not sting with the convoys of martyrs, wounded, detainees, and freedom fighters until they attained their ultimate goal of full liberation. It has been three full years where the Palestinian Unified Resistance on all historic Palestine has been working in a semi-synchronized manner for the first time in history. The clear evidence of that unity was seen in many previous battles, from the Sword of Al-Quds to the unity of battlefields to the last week's Revenge of the Free battle, during which the Al-Quds brigades in Gaza fired more than 1,200 missiles using anti-aircraft missiles and Cornet missiles for the first time. The resistance does not bargain with the entire Palestinian map as its historic homeland. It is the land of prophetic messages and the gateway to heaven, and it is the land of the ancestors and fathers. So no one has the right to give up even an inch of its sacred soil, not under the slogans of political realism, progression, or any other slogan, since such an arrogant enemy only understands the language of power. The only dialogue the resistance in Palestine is ready to engage with is the dialogue of fire with fire. So, on the 75th centenary of the tragic Nakba, the Palestinian resistance made it crystal clear that as long as it has a proud and benevolent people backing it, a people that has never been stingy to pay the bill of blood in order to restore their rights in their homeland. Hence, it is simply the resistance's duty, commitment, and wisdom not to let this great people down and not to squander their dreams of liberation. On the 75th centenary of the Nakba, the national, patriotic, religious, and moral duty calls not only at the Palestinian resistance, but the entire axis of resistance to work diligently and constantly to achieve the collective aspirations of the peoples of West Asia to defeat and conquer the usurping Zionist entity. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Al-Nakba Day, or the Day of Tragedy, is a day that even more than 75 years after its occurrence has not been erased from the minds of the free people of the world and Palestine. On this day, many Palestinians were forced to leave their homes due to the brutal actions of the occupying Zionist regime. Nakba is a term referring to the war between the Zionist colonial forces and the Palestinians in 1948, which eventually led to the establishment of the fake Israeli regime and displaced more than 800,000 Palestinians. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Suhail Al-Natour, Director of the Human Development Center and a native Palestinian political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Suhail. Now, Palestinians do not have a happy memory of Al-Nakba Day 1948. They also do not forget their right the right that was taken away from them on that day. And every year on the 15th of May, with protests and rallies, they remember the ongoing misery that was bestowed upon their people. Now, 75 years later, what does that day mean to Palestinians as the oppression and the occupation continues in all of historic Palestine?
Well, I think this time is different. First, 75 years, that means three quarters of a century. And second, this is the first time that we witness that the Palestinians are not only gathering some people in this camp or that camp to celebrate the remembrance of this catastrophe. It's also mingled this time with the test of victory done by the resistance of the Palestinians last few days in Gaza and in West Bank. So this time that 75 years passed, and every time we Palestinians try to remember and to remind the others of the catastrophe happened to our people. But this time, we are much more sure that we are going one step forward by the unity of the Palestinian resistance groups, by the steadfastness of the Palestinians in Gaza and West Bank, and by the continuous and upheaval of the broad masses in the Arab world and Islamic world for the Palestinians. So this is not an ordinary occasion this time. This is a turning point that the question now is for the Zionists to ask about their future in the area, while the Palestinians are much more confirmed in their mentality that what we struggled for, the right of return and the liberation of Palestine and self-determination, will be done step by step consecutively.
Well, Dr. Sohail, during the 1948 conflict, we had more than 530 Palestinian towns and villages were razed to the ground. We had more than 15,000 Palestinians martyred. Dozens of Palestinians were executed en masse. Yet Israel celebrates that day, celebrates today as an Independence Day, flaunting its crime of genocide for the whole world to see and say nothing about. Will there ever be justice for the Palestinians murdered by the Haganah terrorist gangs?
The Israelis committed all these crimes under the pretext that they are defending the establishment of a new state in the Middle East, and they created the illusion that this is the only democratic state in the Middle East that they were accusing the others. I think this time is very clear. What we witness, not only in the Palestinian gatherings, in the Arab cities and villages, in Europe, before coming a few minutes ago, it was in Danish biggest demonstration asking for justice for the Palestinians of a Nakba. It's not only the West Bank or to stop only the attacks against Gaza. They want the rights for self-determination for the whole Palestinian people. So the right of these murdered people will be done when we will have our freedom again. We will have the application practically of the right of return, and when we practice to have an independent state with Jerusalem its capital.
Well, 75 years later, we see today that the Palestinian resistance is capable more than ever. It is obliging the Zionist entity to hide and shelter in shelters and bomb shelters with their retaliatory missiles that they are sending towards occupied Palestine every time the Israeli entity tries to bomb or bombs Gaza, or lately even every time Israel attacks the Al-Aqsa Mosque as well. We have also been following the development of a very effective resistance in the West Bank as well, also over the past 3 years. Where does that put the Zionist regime in the upcoming decade? Will there be a Zionist regime after 10 years from today?
I think the turning point of 75 years celebration is, as I said, is coming with a part of victory of resistance of the Palestinians in Gaza and West Bank. And in this, that the question is, are we going to continue our struggle with this steadfastness, with this capacity of giving sacrifices until reaching the liberation of Palestine and to oblige the Israelis? What I see in the future, that the Israelis are going to ask themselves, does it need to continue in this fluctuating situation of non-certainty, non-peaceful situation? I think that the Palestinians reach a point that the decreasing situation of the Israelis is felt by a lot of pro-Israelis. That's why all the Palestinian people and their supporters must concentrate on negating all these illusions of this apartheid state and to diminish the flow of money and weapons to this state until the Palestinians will create their independent state.
Well, that is our hope and that is what we wish for, but apparently that is what the Palestinian resistance is also working towards, especially after the last that we saw last week in the freedom or the battle of revenge of the free that we saw in Gaza. The way that the Palestinian resistance was able in less than 3 days to launch more than 1,200 missiles against an entity that 75 years ago eliminated more than 70% of Palestine. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Suhail Al-Natour, Director of the Human Development Center and Native Palestinian political commentator, for joining us to remember with us the massacred and tormented people of Palestine since 1948 up until today. Thank you for being with us. Now, please stay tuned, because after the break, we are going to talk about the basic reason behind all this torment, the Sykes-Picot, after the break.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
On similar days like these in 1916, the British and French occupations began their negotiations about tearing up the Arab East, what was historically known natural Syria and Iraq, dividing it between them in mid-May of the same year in what was known as the Sykes-Picot Agreement. However, the borders drawn by that agreement, according to which the countries of the Middle East were established, now seem to have entered a stage of change and transformation. More details in this following report.
Exactly 107 years ago, the two main colonial powers at that time, Britain and France, signed a secret agreement, later known as Sykes-Picot, under which the legacy of the Ottoman Empire in the Middle East was divided after its defeat in the First World War. However, the borders drawn by that agreement, according to which the countries of the Middle East were established, now more than 100 years later, seems to have entered a stage of change and transformation. The current borders of the region were formed through a long and complex process of agreements, conferences, deals, and conflicts that followed the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire and in the aftermath of the end of the First World War. However, the spirit of Sykes-Picot remained alive during that stage and the subsequent decades until the Suez Canal crisis in 1956 and until the following period. During that stage, the colonial powers imposed their will, established entities and states, and installed rulers loyal to them to serve their interests only, without regard to ethnic, national, geographical, religious, or linguistic considerations in countries like Palestine, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. This ethnic, racial, religious, and sectarian mixture in these countries has turned into an explosive mixture as soon as they face crises or challenges, or the ruler's strong grip in holding all the joints of power loosens, as happened in Lebanon in the last century. However, given the current wave of transformations in West Asia, especially with the victories of the axis of resistance which comprises Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Iran, and Yemen against the Western-backed wave of terrorism and hegemony, Sykes-Picot is over, that's for sure. But at the moment, everything is murky. But it won't be a long time before the outcome becomes clear. What is remarkable today is that since before the 1948 Nakba, the international and regional transformation did not happen to be in favor of the Palestinian cause as they are now. The infamous Sykes-Picot Agreement started with Palestine, and it seems to be ending inside of it too. It is a Palestinian moment that must be exploited internally instead of being exploited by the occupation for its own benefit. These transformations begin with Ukraine and do not end with the Chinese presence in the West Asian region, passing through the Iranian-Saudi reconciliation and the return of normalizing Arab regimes to a victorious Syria after they had invested heavily in destroying it. Regional reconciliations can be used to serve Palestinian goals as a priority and later on regional Levantine goals. Here, these goals and methods of achieving them must be identified. The end of historic Sykes-Picot is by far a Palestinian moment first and foremost, during which an integrated Palestinian project can be built that can be imposed amid all the transformations. For the first time in history, we are witnessing regional participation in geopolitical changes rather than being simply followers affected by these changes.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ma'an Bashour, Secretary General of the Arab National Conference. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Bashour. Now, 107 years later, has Sykes-Picot served its initial purpose in West Asia?
There is no doubt that what we have seen over the course of a century and a half since the signing of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which was immediately followed by the Balfour Declaration, we have noticed that the Zionist colonial scheme succeeded in some stages and in some aspects. But I think that all these years were years of resistance to the effects of this treaty and the effects of the Balfour Declaration. It is no coincidence that the Balfour Declaration, which is the promise from "He who does not own to those who do not deserve," was launched at the same time as the signing of the Sykes-Picot Agreement on this day more than 100 years ago. This is due to the Zionist project that aimed to replace the Palestinians with the Zionists on the land of Palestine, which is part of this treaty that aimed to divide the region. We must always remember the British position since the middle of the 18th century, when the British Prime Minister, Henry Palmerston, stood and said, after the arrival of the Egyptian armies at the gates of Turkey, that we have to erect a barrier between Egypt and the Levant. The barrier was the Zionist entity, and the project was the fragmentation of the Levant all the way to Egypt, which brought about the stage of division that we see flourishing today in many West Asian countries.
Well, Dr. Bashour, the land of the Syrian, Iraqi, and Lebanese geography, after more than 100 years of Sykes-Picot in 2016, or actually at the 100 years of Sykes-Picot in 2016, started recording a great victory through the trio of the Syrian Arab Army, the Lebanese Resistance, and the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Forces. This was evident with the liberation of the Qalamun, the liberation of Arsal, the liberation of many Syrian governorates as well in Syria and in Iraq as well. How do the sponsors of Sykes-Picot view these developments in West Asia?
There is no doubt that the advocates of Sykes-Picot are falling in one dilemma after the other. Perhaps the most recent of these dilemmas is what we saw in the past days, in the Battle of Revenge of the Free in Gaza, which lasted for 5 days, in which the enemy entered arrogantly, only to end up defeated thanks to the steadfastness of the resistance in Palestine and the environs of Palestine. This is not the first time this project has been defeated. There is no doubt that the renewed attack of the Sykes-Picot project, which was represented by the spread of Takfiri terrorists in Iraq, in Syria, and also in Lebanon. They were all defeated thanks to the resistance forces in all these countries, which succeeded in thwarting their plan to divide Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. And the battle continues. Without a doubt, the resistance in Palestine, Syria, Iraq, and of course in Lebanon plays a major role in thwarting Sykes-Picot's goals and in emphasizing that this region must remain united, sovereign, and independent. I believe that in the past weeks, we have witnessed shifts in favor of the Sykes-Picot resistance project, the most prominent of which is undoubtedly the Iranian-Saudi agreement, which created a new atmosphere in the region and the world, as well as developments in the Arab-Arab relations and the invitation of Damascus to attend the Arab League summit in Saudi Arabia. All this indicates that the renewed Sykes-Picot, because Sykes-Picot is multiple rounds and not one continuous round, and seemingly, in its latest version, Sykes-Picot failed in the region thanks to the resistance and thanks to the people of the region embracing their resistance in all these countries.
Well, the ongoing global calamities all around the world, whether wars or economic crises, have severely diminished the influence of once very powerful colonial powers in the region of West Asia. Some view this issue as a vital opportunity for the people of the region to reclaim what was once theirs. How applicable do you think this opportunity is given the current challenges in West Asia?
I believe the changes taking place in the world, the decline in the influence of the colonial countries that dominated this region, the economic and social crisis taking place within these colonial powers, the ethnic and political conflicts that have taken place, and even within the deep state itself in the United States, all of this constitutes opportunities that the people of our region must take advantage of to attain more liberation, more solidarity, and more cohesion, especially around an issue that brings us all together as Arabs, Muslims, and